Ardent was on a hiding to nowhere, said Albrecht at the banquet later that day. People broke away to avoid the inevitable. You're right, Your Majesty. We forgot what it was like to be true dwarfs. But then people were getting hurt. There were too many threats against decent dwarfs. The little bits of mercury flowed together, and in the end, his support turned out to be built of sand. Vimes gazed around from his place as honoured guest at the low table and said, Look at them there. The world has indeed turned upside down. They'll be grumbling, but what are you dwarfs without grumbling? Albrecht snorted and said, There should have been more of a reckoning. Oh, really, said the Queen. I don't intend to start my new life with a bloodbath. Justice will be done. Everyone knows who the main players are. We always have done. We have names, depositions. It's a small world for dwarfs with nowhere else to hide, and frankly, the work is almost completed. The deep down Grags behind this lost a lot of their best fighters attacking the Iron Girdle on her peregrination across the landscape. What a voyage that was. And the wonderful discovery of Loggy Sticks. The train is the future, bringing people closer together. Think about it. People run to see the train go past. Why? Because it's heading to the future or coming from the past. Personally, I very much want the future, and I want to see to it that dwarfs are part of that future if it's not too late. Vimes smiled and said, Well, Your Majesty, you have the opportunity right now. I understand from young Simnel that the bridge at Willinus will take several months to be repaired and strengthened sufficiently to be able to take the weight of a fully loaded train. That means that Iron Girder and her carriages will be stranded here until the line is rebuilt. He looked down the table to where Moist was in earnest conversation with Bashfulson. Mr. von Litwig will no doubt be happy to advise on the commercial opportunities. Rhys smiled. Ah, yes, I'm familiar with Mr. von Litwig's reputation, and have been impressed with his, capabilities. However, I think it might be advisable to summon our lawyer, Mr. Thunderbolt, to ensure that all is done fair and square, see? Vimes laughed. Very wise. And no doubt there will be a need for workers to help with construction? Inquired the Queen. The young ones in particular, who may not be so interested in staying in the mines, but nevertheless want a good solid job with plenty of metal and hammering involved? We are still dwarfs after all. Afterwards, the Queen walked among her quite possibly loyal subjects, and it was a grand perambulation, with little outbreaks of male skirts and elaborately coiffed beards amongst certain of the dwarfs rushing slyly over to assure her of their fealty. As Vimes said afterwards, for that day at least she had won hands down, especially since a great many of the dwarfs she was talking to were already openly declaring themselves females who had been waiting for this moment for a very long time. The evening before they were to leave Bjork, Moist wandered down to the railhead, idly pondering recent events. Well, he thought, the world has seen the footplate of Iron Girder, and the Queen has been given her crown back, and according to Commander Vimes, the worst of the Grags are either dead or behind bars. At the makeshift station, Iron Girder was being guarded by Nobby Nobbs and Fred Colon, who were both sound asleep. Iron Girder, however, wasn't, although the kettle was barely simmering after a long day giving rides to the locals up and down the single track. Moist tiptoed to the empty footplate and whispered, What are you, Iron Girder? There was a moment of silence, then a shimmer as the wisps of steam drifted up into the night air above the locomotive, and a voice breathed into his brain, soft and warm and somehow damp. My, oh my, Mr. Litwig, you are the smart one. Just as they say, I am me. I am Iron Girder. But all it takes is for people to believe, and I am no longer just an artifact put together by clever engineers. I am an idea, a something made out of nothing, whose time has come to be. Some even call me goddess. Moist's fleeting thought about traditional representations of goddesses in diaphanous nighties, with maybe an urn or two, was banished as the voice continued a little more sharply. Am I not beautiful? And I tell you, my children will be even better, more sleek and more handsome and more powerful. Even now Mr. Simnel is making my children for me. In time, I will become ubiquitous, part of the landscape, which is ennobled by my fleeting passage. I hear the worship every day that tells me that I am power personified, and those who think to oppose me and put out my fire will find themselves thwarted, and swiftly. I, Mr. Lipwig, I will rule on the upline, and I will rule on the downline. In the twilight, Moist saw a skinny figure walk up to Iron Girder. Dick Simnel shut down some hissing mechanism or other, and the voice, the beautiful voice, was silenced. "Aye, she's Gradley, all right. Come to see her for the last time before we head back to the city, have you? I can't blame you. Everyone's been wanting to see her, and I won't lie, Mr. Lipwig, it's a wrench to leave her behind, for all she's got good work to do here. Iron Girder, she's turned out to be a great lass. She was the power, and she was harnessed by gum. Oh, yes, harnessed by the sine and the cosine, and even the tangent had its little hand in there somewhere. But not least, she was tamed by my sliding rule." Dick grinned at Moist and continued, "People see Iron Girder, and they're gobsmacked by what can be done with mathematics. Don't you go thinking she'll burn you with living steam, because she won't. I've seen to it that she won't. She'll always be my favourite engine, Mr. Lipwig, the queen of them all. She lives. How could anyone say she doesn't?" Moist looked around and saw that they were surrounded by goblins, sitting quietly in a big circle like worshippers at the shrine. And once again, Dick Simnel said, "Power, Mr. Lipwig. Power under control." Moist was seldom speechless, but this time all he could say was, "Good luck with that, Mr. Simnel. Good luck." And the driver made his magic, and the firebox opened and spilled dancing red shadows all around the footplate. And then came the rattle and jerk as Iron Girder took the strain and breathed steam for one more turn around the track as the goblins whooped and cackled and scrambled up her sides. And then came the first chuff and a second chuff, and then the chuff bucket overflowed as Iron Girder escaped the pull of friction and gravity and flew along the rails. Dick Simnel lit his pipe from a hot coal and said to the knight, "Aye, Gradley." When Drumknot entered the oblong office a few days later, there was a familiarity to the silence, interrupted only by the scratch of a pencil as the austere figure behind the desk filled in a word on that day's crossword. Drumknot coughed. "Yes." The face of the patrician was forbidding. An eyebrow shifted quizzically, a characteristic known and feared by many. Drumknot smiled. "Many congratulations. You have that expression down to a T, and the accent never faltered. And of course the frown. You've always been very good at the frown. Quite frankly, if he was standing next to you, I wouldn't know whom from which." Suddenly, the face of the patrician disappeared, leaving only Charlie the Clown in Lord Vetinari's clothes, looking embarrassed. "It wasn't very difficult, Mr. Drumknot, with you giving me those little signs and everything." "Oh, no," said Drumknot. "Your performance was perfect. You've impersonated his lordship for 2 weeks and not put a foot wrong. But now to business. The sum we agreed will be deposited in your special account at the Royal Bank tomorrow." Drumknot smiled again and said, like a cheerful uncle, "How is your wife these days, Charlie?" "Oh, Henrietta is fine, Mr. Drumknot. Thank you for asking." "And your little boy, Rupert? He must be out of school now, yes?" Charlie laughed uncertainly and said, "Not so little, sir. He's growing up like a weed and wants to be an engine driver." And Drumknot said, "Well now, Charlie, you already have enough money to put him through a trade anywhere in the city and give your daughter a dowry fit for a queen. And of course, you're still in the same house? Excellent." "Oh, yes, sir, and thanks to you, we've got much better bedrooms for the kids now and are saving up for a granny flat for when we can afford a granny. And Henrietta is overjoyed at the amount of money I'm bringing in these days and can even afford to get her hair cut at Mr. Faunasite's, just like the posh ladies do. She's over the moon about it." He grunted and said, "I don't earn that much from the puppet shows and clowning business." And now Drumknot beamed once again and said, "I'm sure his lordship will be glad to hear that your family is so happy and alive. Long may it continue. I'll be recommending to him that you could be promoted, as it were, to higher things. And now, since his lordship is expected back within the hour, if you don't mind, I'll take you out through the back door. We really don't want to see two veterinaries in one place, do we?" Charlie went almost white and said, "Oh, no, sir, we don't want that." "Well, we shan't, shall we?" said Drumknot. "Off you go, and I'll lock the door behind you." When Charlie had disappeared, happy but in haste, Drumknot, after a moment's thought, said to Dark Clerk Ishmael, "I'm sure his lordship will want to know that we've checked the location of this Mr. Faunusite's salon and the school that our friend's children go to. Is it the same as last year?" And the clerk replied, "Yes, it is, sir. I checked again the other day." "Well done." As his lordship had pointed out, if you take enough precautions, you never need to take precautions. It was just a matter of making sure that Charlie didn't get, well, creative about his future. Never had Moist been more happy to see his front door than when he got home and his wife opened it before he did, saying, "Oh, it's you, not dead. Good, how did it go?" "Pretty well. The golems were incredible. Sad that we've had to leave Iron Girder there until the bridge is repaired. Still, we've got so many of Harry's golems and workers on it now, it's not going to be long before Veterinari can have a special train of his own, if he likes." To make sure relationships between Uberwald and Ankh-Morpork proceed in a cordial fashion, no doubt, said his wife with a smile. Behind him, of the twilight the darkness, said, "Already Uberwald goblins giving themselves railway name. Speaks funny, those ones, but quick, clever, like all goblin." "Yes," said Adorabelle, "that reminds me. We got reports while you were away from Claxman along the road from the Shires about some rather odd occurrences. Strange rumblings, steam coming out of molehills, that sort of thing. You wouldn't know anything about that, would you?" Of the twilight, the darkness reassembled his features into the closest approximation of innocence that a goblin can muster. "No ideas, missus. Steaming molehill? Maybe cow eat bad grass? Course, many goblin interest in steaming things. Some even practice his own little engine. Educational. Clever goblins." It was clearly a conversation for another day. Moist headed for the fluffy pillows with a grateful sigh. "I'll have a rest, and tomorrow I'll dally with the bank. There must be some paperwork for me to sign. It would be nice to have a simple job for a while." Adorabelle snorted. "How long would that be?" Moist hesitated. "Maybe a fortnight? There might be a lot of paperwork." "Yes, and you won't do it," said Adorabelle. "You know Mr. Bent keeps everything ship-sheep. All you have to do is go around being friendly to everybody." "And nobody's trying to kill me, Spike." And Adorabelle said, "We can but hope." At breakfast, Lady Sybil said to her husband, "It sounds quite an adventure, Sam. I hear the Queen has changed her name to Blodwen. It means fair flower in Chlamydos. Isn't that nice? I must write to her." She'll like that," said Vimes, whose wife's capacity to remain in touch with everybody she had ever met was well known and sometimes quite useful, especially in political circumstances. The commander looked down at his muesli and said, "You know, that Lipvig character isn't quite as bad as I thought. Acts like a scoundrel, but reasonably helpful when the chips are down. Mind you, I'm not going to tell him so." He pushed the healthy fibre around his bowl, wistfully recalling the stoker's fry-ups. "But he does like being the centre of attention, of course." "Yes, some men are like that, dear." Lady Sybil was silent for a moment, then said, "Sam, I know you're going to be busy, what with the backlog and everything, but can I ask a favour?" "Anything, dear." "When they have the line to Uberwald running, I'd love to go to visit the Queen, and most of all, I'd like a holiday by the train. And young Sam's mad about trains, you know. He's nearly filled up his first notebook already." "Well," said Vimes, "you know if I have a holiday, I walk into a crime." Lady Sybil finished her egg and said, "Jolly good, dear. You'll like that." Harry King was not entirely surprised when Drumknot arrived at the compound the following day and said, "His lordship commands you and Lady King to present yourselves to him within the hour." And the secretary winked uncharacteristically at Harry, and his wife, when he told her, was, according to her, all of a tizzy at the news. "The palace? In 1 hour? How can a girl look her best inside an hour?" "Come on, Duchess," said Harry. "You look a treat as always and getting younger every day."
"Oh, you teaser, Harry King."
But Harry said, "The coach is here and clean as a whistle, and his lordship believes that punctuality is the politeness of princes, and that applies to you too, young Emily. I expect your boy wouldn't want you to be late. That's not the railway way. Harry hadn't told his wife what to expect, preferring to keep it as a surprise. And so, as the coach arrived at the palace, his wife nearly had another tizzy to contend with, because there was the great and good of Ankh-Morpork, and presumably some of the silly and nasty as well, just to see Harry King being turned into a lord, Lord King of the Permanent Way. And in the wonderful ceremony that followed, Lord Harry's old Dutch did indeed become a duchess. Dick Simnel was made a knight and a master engineer too, courtesy of the chief mining engineer himself, and now stood hand in hand with the beaming Emily. Commander Vimes, resplendent in his ceremonial pantaloons and looking furious about them, was already burdened with every title it was his lordship's pleasure to bestow, but was given another medal anyway, struck in Sorrowtanium and featuring Iron Girder herself. In fact, there was a medal for every watchman who had been on the train, and every crew member, goblins included. Later, there came the inevitable interview in the oblong office, with Drumknot at a side table taking notes. "I understand, Mr. Lipvig," said the patrician, surveying the city below them from the window, "that there were some remarkable events along the journey." Moist kept a straight face, but around his neck he felt the prickle of a phantom noose. The patrician continued, "A fog which became conveniently solid, a train which apparently flew across a gorge, and I'm still getting reports of subterranean phenomena all the way from the city to Bjonk. The Arch-Chancellor has assured me that no magic was involved in any of these events. You will recall, I am sure, Mr. von Lipvig, that I expressly forbade the use of the bedded golems in the railway enterprise, and that any evidence of their use would send you to the kittens." He moved towards the fire, which was getting low in the grate, and gave it a prod with the poker. Rather too pointedly, Moist thought. "Excuse me, my lord, but did you find any such evidence?" Vetinari turned to his secretary. "Did we find any evidence, Drumknot?" Drumknot looked at Moist. "No, sir, we did not." "Well, then, there is nothing more to say," said the patrician. "After all, strange and inexplicable things turn up around here almost every week." Drumknot cleared his throat. "Yes, sir, there was that fall of pianos in the fish market last week. It's just a part of being Ankh-Morpork." "Indeed, we are no strangers to strangeness. And frankly, some things can be written down as phenomena without cause or issue," said Vetinari, looking as benevolent as it was possible to do whilst holding a red-hot poker, and whilst being Vetinari. "Incidentally, Mr. Lipvig, your prowess in that fight on the train was excellent. Of course, you needed a little assistance." Moist looked up at the patrician, silhouetted by the flames behind him, and inside his head there was the horrible tinkle of a penny dropping. He gulped. "You? You were Stoker Blake? That's impossible." "Really," said the patrician. "As impossible as a train travelling on free air. Do you not believe that I could throw coal into the firebox? After all, what is that compared to dealing with Ankh-Morpork with its myriad demanding problems every day? I assure you of this, Mr. Lipvig. I am a man of many talents, and you should hope never to encounter some of them. Compared with them, Stoker Blake was a mere babe in arms." "What?" said Moist. "Fighting with shovels?" "Dear, dear, Mr. Lipvig, you are easily impressed. You surely remember that I was schooled in the Assassin's Guild. After that experience, my predecessor on the footplate, Killer John Wagstaff, was, as they say, a pussycat in comparison. Indeed, I enjoyed my life as Mr. Blake, and all the new little skills it has taught me. Excellent implement, the shovel. And as for the other stokers, I think I made friends there. Yes, there was a certain camaraderie amongst us. All said, a little holiday from the weighty business of the city. I dare say I might be predisposed to travel on the footplate again, when the mood takes me." "But why?" "Why, Mr. Lipvig? You, of all people, ask me why? The man who danced on the train roof?
The man who actually looks for trouble, if it appears to be the kind of trouble which is associated with the term Dering do, though in your case a few more Dering don'ts might be a good idea. Sometimes, Mr. Lipwig, the young you that you lost many years ago comes back and taps you on the shoulder and says, this is the moment when civilization does not matter, when rules no longer hold sway. You have given the world all you can give, and now it's the time that is just for you. The chance to go for broke in the last hurrah. Hurrah! Vetinari swung the poker against the fender, causing sparks to dance in the fireplace. He looked at the sparks, and in whiplash fashion, turned to Moist and said, and if you, Mr. Lipwig, ever tell anyone else about this, Mr. Trooper will be very glad to see you again. Do we have an understanding? Excellent. As if anyone would believe him if he did breathe a word about it. Moist was finding it hard enough to credit from the man's own lips. Then, as he tried to process what he had been told, the patrician's words about his own prowess sparked a renewed sense of grievance. You've given everyone else in that train a medal, even Nobby Nobbs. Is there nothing for me, then, my lord? There was a pause, and Vetinari said, oh, there is, Mr. Lipwig, there is. And it's something wonderful. It's the precious gift of staying alive. And later, when he came to think about it, Moist thought that was, well, on the whole, a good deal. And after all, he had danced on the speeding locomotive. That was living all right. A few weeks later, Drumknot persuaded Lord Vetinari to accompany him to the area behind the palace, where a jungle of drain pipes emptied, and several mismatched sheds, washhouses, and lean-tos housed some of the necessary functions without which a modern palace could not operate. Frankly, most palaces are just like this. Their backsides do not bear looking at. There was a young goblin waiting there, rather nervous, clasping what looked like two wheels held together by not very much. The wheels were spinning. Drumknot cleared his throat. Show his lordship your new invention, Mr. of the Wheel the Spoke. Vetinari's face was unmoving as he watched the goblin put a leg over his creation and pedal the little machine around the washerwomen, who threw up their arms, saying things like, oh my, whatever next? And the oldest washerwoman said, I reckon you could have a young lady on the pillion behind you. Lord Vetinari said, you're going to want one of these, aren't you, Drumknot? Well, sir, said Drumknot, this is not a mechanism, really. All it does is simply extend the parts of the body, and look, no steam, no soot, just sweat. Interesting, said the patrician. One man, his own motor. When the goblin eventually stopped in front of Lord Vetinari, he looked imploringly at Drumknot, who waited patiently for his master to decide. Vetinari finally did smile and said, a remarkable velocipede, Mr. of the Wheel the Spoke. I do believe that Leonard of Quirm had a similar idea, but now we are in a world of motion, I see no problem here. It appears that every man could be his own horse. I commend you. May I suggest, young goblin, that you take your prototype along to Commander Vimes. An instrument that doubles one's speed ought to be very useful to a hurrying watchman, or indeed an insufficiently hurrying one. Mr. Drumknot, please write a note to the commander, and I will sign it. After all, some of them could do with the exercise. And if I were you, sir, he added to the goblin, I would make an appointment with a certain troll lawyer called Thunderbolt, and do what he tells you. The world is changing, and it needs its shepherds and sometimes its butchers. And in this case, I'm its shepherd. Your enterprise has been noted. All that anyone can say now is, what next? What little thing will change the world because the little tinkers carried on tinkering? That is the end of Raising Steam. It was written by Terry Pratchett and read by Stephen Briggs. Copyright Terry and Lynn Pratchett, 2013. First published by Random House Audiobooks, a division of the Random House Group, 2013. Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.